In this podcast, Dr. James Donald will speak about his research looking at compulsive internet use in young adolescents, the adverse impact on mental and psychological health, as you may expect, is significant. This podcast is as important to us as parents as it is to us as GPs. Dr. Donald, please tell us about yourself.
Hi, David, and it's great to be here. So, yes, I'm a lecturer at the University of Sydney, and I've been exploring issues around internet use and problematic internet use for a couple of years now.
Now, you've written some studies on the what is called the compulsive use of the internet. Can you tell us a little bit about the studies and your findings?
Sure. So my research group and I have now published three studies looking at really trying to ask the question, what are the antecedents and consequences of compulsive internet use among adolescents? So by adolescents, I mean high school students. And in our study, we tracked around 3,000 adolescents across Australia for 4 years and wanted to understand how their well-being, their ability to regulate their emotions and their self-esteem relates to how they're using the internet.
And what were your findings?
So as I say, we've published three studies now. The first study was looking at the links between compulsive internet use and mental health. Mm-hmm. Second was looking at self-esteem and a construct called hope, which is really about having a sense of efficacy in your life. And the most recent study that we published this year was looking at emotion regulation issues among adolescents. And interestingly, across each of these three studies, we found consistent evidence that for young people who report having issues with using the internet too much or in compulsive ways, that this precedes difficulties with mental health, self-esteem, and emotion regulation, and not the other way around. Mm. So, for example, having pre-existing issues with regulating your emotions in general didn't predict subsequent difficulties with the internet. Mm-hmm. So basically the bottom line of our research is it seems that the there are downstream problems associated with compulsive internet use, and that general issues with mental health, self-esteem, and emotion regulation are not leading to internet use problems.
Mm-hmm. So you've certainly found that there is a chicken and an egg.
Exactly. And the longitudinal study, these four years of the study enabled us to tease that apart a bit.
Now, this is becoming very important because, you know, sometimes for parents and even for anyone, teasing out the difference between someone who uses the internet frequently and someone who is a compulsive user may be difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are obviously, like almost everything, shades of grey here. And it's really about understanding what kind of impact is a young person, or as you say, an adult, use of the internet impeding or impinging on other aspects of their life. And that, for me, is really where the rubber hits the road.
So, lacking a clear definition, are there some guiding criteria by which we can use to say, right, you've got a problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's been, as I'm sure many of your listeners are aware, there's been quite a lot of debate around this whole question of compulsive internet use or internet addiction, as it's often referred to. Is it actually a disorder, or is it basically just an amalgam or a reflection of other things that are going on in people's lives that are basically it's a symptom of? And there's a lot of debate around this. So for the purposes of our research, we kind of decided to sidestep those debates and instead home in on, well, what are the behavioural markers that we're interested in? And a fair bit of work's gone into nailing those down, or at least identifying plausible markers. And so, for example, in our research, we looked at a number of different, markers or indicators that the young people in our study responded in relation to, and there were really five. So the first was, as I say, this is in relation to compulsive internet use, as opposed to perhaps a more acute form of addiction. And the first was loss of control over just your ability to regulate your time online, spending excessive amounts of time online, having trouble actually stopping. You know, a second one is a preoccupation, so a mental and behavioral preoccupation, thinking about, you know, online conversations or activities or games or whatever while you're offline. So that sense of, you know, mental preoccupation. Withdrawal, so a sense of irritability or frustration when offline, so withdrawing from non-online activities, if you will, particularly relevant if you've got an adolescent in your house. I'm sure many people could relate to that. And then coping, the fourth one was coping, so basically going online to help yourself cope with, for example, a low mood. So that was number four. And then the fifth sort of marker that we used was the extent to which people experience conflict in their broader life, whereby they are neglecting, you know, other offline tasks like, you know, in the case of teenagers, you know, school study or other social commitments, and that there's this sense of conflict in their life that's as a result of their online activity. So those were the five, as I say, sort of indicators or markers that we used in our research.
Well, they're fairly clear markers, and I hope that you'll be able to send us through those five markers, because I'm sure it'd be nice for us to refer to later on.
Sure, very happy to do that. Yeah.
Having said that, I want to go back to your findings and just really understand a little bit more about what hope means and what emotional dysregulation really is about.
That's a fair questions. So the study that we did looking at hope, which was a 2018 study, basically this is asking young people to subjectively report about the extent to which they're able to set goals in their life, number one, and number two, have a sense of agency or efficacy in setting goals in their life. So really important, I would argue, foundational building block of a young person, or indeed anyone's sense of well-being and functioning. So that's what this construct, hope that we looked at, really is about. Mm-hmm. And in terms of looking at emotion dysregulation or emotion regulation, so in that was our more recent paper, where we basically looked at six different components of emotion dysregulation, asking the question, how does compulsive internet use impact or is it impacted by these? Mm-hmm. So these are general difficulties to regulating one's emotions. So things like difficulty managing impulses, so impulsive reactions or responses to situations, difficulty having an awareness of one's emotional states and clarity around one's emotions, so linked to alexithymia and things like that. And then also difficulty accepting one's emotions, especially strong negative emotions. And the final two components that we looked at were really about efficacy in the presence of negative emotions. So setting goals and identifying strategies for dealing with strong negative emotions. And they might be quite practical strategies like stepping outside, drinking a glass of water, calling a friend, those kinds of things. So it was a fairly relatively fine-grained study of different elements of emotion dysregulation.
Now, after 4 years of studies, how affected were the subjects that you were dealing with? Were they able to sort of have a life, or were they at a position where they were really unable to make plans or deal with, as you said, those negative impulses and negative emotional?
Yeah, so basically what we found in our studies, because these were longitudinal studies, we were able to track young people's levels on all of these things, including emotion regulation difficulties, over the course of their high school years, from years 8 to year 11. And what we found was that it basically varied. But in general, we found that young people's ability to regulate their emotions was sort of their level, if you like, of ability was relatively stable across those years. However, if you're a young person that reports being a compulsive user of the internet, that ability was basically gradually and consistently eroded over the 4 years of those 4 years of adolescence.
Were there any subjects who managed better than others? And if so, were there mitigating factors, both internally or externally, that might protect them?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And frankly, more research is needed to nail down some of these questions and some of these particular risk factors. For example, certain issues around parental support, peer support, social support. And indeed, these are studies, David, that are in the pipeline for our research group. But a couple of things we can say based on what we know so far. One of them is that in our studies, we did not find evidence that young people's general personality factors, such as self-esteem, such as hope and emotion regulation, these factors did not precede difficulties with regulating internet use, suggesting that it's kind of like an equal opportunity issue, that it's not young people with specific issues on these kind of general life management, let's call it, capabilities, that is preceding or leading to internet use problems. And indeed, the sort of the evidence that we have before us at least points to perhaps more structural as opposed to personality factors that warrant further investigation in terms of the drivers of this particular issue.
I say this more as equal risks. I love the term equal opportunity because it really does mean it doesn't matter whether or not you are, if you like, a more resilient, in a more capable person. If the structures around you are wrong, you could easily slide down this slope then.
Absolutely. And even things like socioeconomic status, geographic location, parents' income level. I mean, we know from, more generally that these kinds of factors tend to be quite important in predicting young people's success and, you know, study adherence and these kinds of things. But in our study, we basically had a pretty representative sample across each of those sort of demographics, if you like, rural, regional, urban, you know, high, medium, low income, and a range of parental education levels. So again, these things indicate that this is a pretty sort of endemic issue. And I think anecdotally, we see that as well.
Were there structures around teenagers' lives that were both constructive and protective? Things that actually can stop them sliding down this route?
Yeah. No, indeed. And our research wasn't directly addressing that question. But I think from what we know more broadly, there are several so-called structural factors that appear to be pretty important around this. And they would include boundary setting, from parents. And I think a big issue, and we're seeing this more and more in the research, is that these issues are affecting younger and younger children. As early as preschool, in a couple of studies that I've seen, and certainly primary school. So it's this whole perennial issue of early intervention is the goal. Mm-hmm. Setting those clear boundaries from a young age mm-hmm. Seems to really be the place to begin. And a whole lot more as well, I might add, which I'm happy to elaborate on.
I would love you to tell us a little bit more, because this affects us as parents and as doctors.
Indeed. Well, basically with the boundaries, so the many of your listeners will be familiar with this, the Australian National Physical Activity and Sedentary Guidelines recommend, 2 hours a day maximum for for five-year-olds through to teenagers, and 1 hour for 2 to 5-year-olds. So it's a fairly contained recommendation. And again, I think that's a pretty straightforward benchmark against which, any parent can kind of assess how they're going with setting those boundaries and of course, implementing them. Another big issue that is, certainly there's some research coming out around this now, is around the whole elephant in the room, if you will, of what happens at nighttime mm-hmm. and young people having unfettered access to the web in their bed. It obviously presents a whole raft of issues and risks for the young person and indeed their family. Obviously sleep quality being the most obvious one, but of course, that in turn impacts diet and of course physical activity and so on. So that would be one. Another interesting, I think more than interesting, significant, a more practical point would be around just simply knowing what your child is doing while they're online. And I mean, these days there are lots and lots of very, very effective and constantly evolving apps that can help parents to monitor. Of course, if we don't know what's happening, we've just got, we're not in a place to intervene. So that would be obviously a critical part of the strategy. And finally, I'd just say that among older children, perhaps sort of 7, 8, 9, 10, and then into high school, just the whole aspect of talking to children and really engaging with them around what their interests are on being online and really understanding what they're engaged with and why they want to engage with certain games or other apps online. And there's a ton of research around the benefits of, autonomy supportive approaches to parenting, as opposed to these are the rules, like it or lump it, which for teenagers is obviously going to be a lot less effective. So that whole thing of really walking the walk, with the child as well would seem to be an important role for parents.
James, I already immediately see a problem. I'm seeing problems of my parents actually not adhering to any of these guidelines.
Right. Yes. Well, they're not easy to implement. I often speak to people about these issues, David, socially and professionally, and they say, James, this is great in theory, but I've got no hope. And I think there's a reason why this issue is getting and continues to get so much airtime. And I'm sure your listeners, doctors around the country are seeing more and more of this. It's challenging. And personally, I would say that it's really, and from what we see in some of the studies coming out, is it's affecting children earlier and earlier. So as a parent, earlier you can really get on the front foot and start thinking about these issues, you know, the better. And the more parents are advised accordingly, you know, the better. I mean, I'm personally amazed at just how liberal parents can be in just allowing their children unfettered access from a very young age. And of course, there are often very good reasons why they would do that. Juggling jobs and busy lives being perhaps among the leading reasons for that. But the consequences we are really starting to see.
Let me just try and understand this. First of all, as parents, if we don't set very clear boundaries for our children, if we don't engage with them about why they're spending so much time on it, if we don't use apps that tell us where they're going, and if we don't restrict their access to it at night, these sorts of things allow any child, it doesn't matter what your predispositions are or your strengths are, any child can slide into compulsive internet use. And what you're telling me is that year after year, the subjects you had studied had their capacity to cope, if you like, eroded. And we are actually looking at large groups of young people growing up with issues relating to planning for the future, having some capacity to deal with strong negative emotions and how to deal with problems in their lives. Is that where we're heading?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the research is unfolding before our eyes. I was just reading a recent meta-analysis done looking at the links between compulsive internet use and cognitive abilities. And again, some fascinating findings there showing that our ability to override our habitual responses to make decisions, working memory, these kinds of things are all meta-analytically linked with compulsive or problematic use of the internet. So, yeah, I mean, we're at the tip of the iceberg, I think. I mean, you know, schools have a big part to play here, not just parents. And I think many schools, and indeed, of course, many families around the country and internationally where this is a massive issue, are really starting to implement some of these strategies and seeing that, yeah, the internet brings so many benefits to our young people, but there are also costs that we have to weigh up very carefully.
One of the things that worry me a lot is the, if you like, the degradation of sleep time and sleep quality in adolescents. You had said that their pre-compulsive internet use personalities didn't really prevent or stop them from becoming, if you like, a compulsive. But when you start to impede and affect their sleep quality, does that not lead to increased anxiety and depression?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We, as you've said, sleep is absolutely foundational to a whole raft of things in terms of a functioning human being. And again, I think we're only just beginning to understand the those downstream consequences. The challenge is, of course, like all research, it takes very expensive, well-designed, longitudinal studies to really understand how these things play out over time. Mm-hmm. But certainly from the emerging evidence that I'm seeing, issues around school engagement, around mental health that you've alluded to, and also diet are, you know, potentially very significant downstream consequences of kids spending, you know, in some cases 15 hours a day somehow, somehow or other online, playing games at night with friends overseas or people I've met overseas and all this kind of thing. So it's certainly a massive issue. And I just simply come back to that point around prevention and early intervention and setting those healthy boundaries. and not being dogmatic either, you know, mm-hmm. not being sort of overly zealous, allowing children access. There are plenty of benefits to all of the great things that the internet brings us, but just like anything, you know, a healthy balance.
Two issues. The first, of course, as parents listening to this program, what should we be aware of in our own parenting? And the second, James, is we are, a lot of us are GPs, and we will be seeing adolescents. What should we be looking out for to know when there is a problem?
Yeah, so two questions there. The first one relating to parenting. I mean, this is a tricky one to answer because obviously development, adolescent, or child development is a complex process that really does change over time as the child develops. In simple terms, certainly from what I've read and seen, and indeed from my own experience, which is worth a lot less, but nonetheless, as a parent, mm-hmm. You know, for the younger years, the early primary years, it is all about boundary setting and being aware as a parent about what the risks are. And where possible, I appreciate that many sections of our society simply can't regulate their children's use of the internet in the way that would be optimal. Mm-hmm. But as best one can, doing that from those young early ages so that some healthy habits are in place, some clear boundaries are in place. And then just like any sort of other boundaries a parent would set, for example, around going out and playing on the street after school, I think would be an appropriate analogy. And then as you move into the latter primary and the early high school years, and as you know, the child and children gain much more independence and autonomy and indeed are required by their schools, by almost every school now, to have a device in order to go to school, therefore online, going to be online much more over that period. It's around, of course, boundary setting, but not just boundary setting, and really engaging with your child, talking to them about what their wanting interests are online and understanding what they're viewing online. That's, of course, where the apps can be very helpful at a very practical level to actually know what they're engaging with online. Mm-hmm. But above all, having conversations and doing that hard work of being a parent will pay dividends down the track, mm-hmm. as opposed to large chunks of unsupervised time where, you know, it's going to be an uphill battle. In terms of GPs seeing families and adolescents with these kinds of issues, we touched on this earlier. It's basically, in a nutshell, it's the extent to which a young person's online activity, and we know there's a lot of variation around this in terms of what people are interested in, the big ones, of course, being gaming, main, you know, predominantly among boys, and just social media and things, predominantly, you know, girls are more represented in that group. But nonetheless, they seem to be the big ones. And really just the extent to which that is really interrupting their life, including, you know, the family's life, getting in the way of healthy family routines like mm-hmm. meals and time together, the extent to which they are irritated and angry. I'm sure any parent listening will be experiencing this or have experienced this when you seek to regulate that use. And also just internet use at more, perhaps slightly more extreme levels, really interrupting other aspects of their life, as we've discussed, sleep, eating, face-to-face social interactions, sport, other interests, and so on and so forth. So that's how I'd characterise it in general terms.
What should we do if we find someone with these sorts of issues?
I mean, basically, a lot of psychologists now are well aware and trained to deal with these kinds of issues. And indeed, there are a number who specialised in this area, as it is a growing area. And indeed, a number of clinics, not just in Australia, but globally, really the incidence or the increase of dedicated clinics to specifically the issue of internet addiction is increasing, by the month. So generally speaking, these issues can be managed. I should hasten to add that, for example, in our study of 3,000 Australian adolescents, between 8 to 10% of the group reported high and above, high to very high dependence on the internet. So it's the absolute minority. And most of these issues can be dealt with via counselling and parental support and intervention where needed. But of course, there are going to be more severe or extreme cases where even referral to psychiatrists would potentially be needed.
I mean, this is a very important issue that you've told us about, James. I'm just hoping that more and more of my peers, and myself included, will be actually formally trying to make this inverted commas diagnosis, just so that we can send our patients for specific help. We need to do that because, as you said, the long-term outcomes are really negative towards leading a constructive and meaningful life.
And I think very briefly, David, on that point, if I may, to that very point, the at least evidence that I'm seeing is it's that early intervention that is so important. So, for example, as a doctor seeing a family where these issues are being raised, really encouraging them to go on and get some specific assistance, I think is a very good investment.
I can think in my mind of, even in the middle of a consultation, the young child raiding mum's bag and pulls up the phone and is playing with it freely. And I suspect you would say that's a big risk factor.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything, as we've been saying, it just comes down to how families, first and foremost, parents are regulating access. I don't think it's rocket science.
No.
I think the challenge is around education.
And as you also said many times, James, it's about us sitting down and speaking as a family and behaving like an old-fashioned family.
Indeed. And of course, as a parent, I'm guilty as charged. You know, we tend to use our phones in ways that are probably not socially appropriate sometimes. So it's all about role modelling too and setting those good examples.
James, do you have any final messages for our listeners?
I think we've really covered a lot. I mean, I think to summarise, the research around this is rapidly unfolding. But I think it's fair to say, based on what we know from the research, that this is a problem that is multi-headed and the consequences of which we simply haven't fully calculated in terms of the downstream impacts. It's one of the biggest experiments we've done with a generation, and we don't know how it's going to unfold. So I think just urging all of the things we've talked about around encouraging families to provide some clear boundaries and guidance. There's the Office of the eSafety Commissioner, which is an excellent resource that parents can access and access resources from. And of course, doctors can refer parents to that. And for cases where young people are really struggling or clearly struggling to counselling and psychotherapy support as well as needed.
I look forward to your future studies. It seems to have incredible relevance for many generations to come. So hopefully, James, I'll be speaking with you in the future about your findings.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for having me, David, and it's a great pleasure to be here.
It's been a real pleasure having you, and I've learned a lot from you. Thank you so much, James.